let's get started here. So just let's start with a quick overview of where we are in the course. So there are about 4 or 5 lectures remaining to go. Okay. At least a couple of those will likely be guest lectures. I usually invite other people to come and talk about related topics like mobile computing and so on in this course. So I haven't yet lined up guest lecturers, but I'm looking to have at least one or two classes be guest lectures. Okay. Other than that, the topics that remain are World Wide Web, distributed object systems. There's Genie and coordination based systems. So there are only 2 or 3 chapters remaining really in the book. So that's maybe 4 or 5 lectures of material. And in terms of the course itself, there is the last programming assignment that has already been put up, and I made it due in the last week of classes, so there should be plenty of time. A couple of homeworks that remain, and I'm going to put one up later today. Okay, so we have done 2 homeworks already. That was before the midterm, and we have 2 more to go, just to keep you up, keep up the pace. And the final, as I already mentioned, is take home. Okay, it is scheduled for the 22nd of May. That's the same date as the final on the exam schedule. Okay, so if you look at the exam schedule, it says 677 as an exam on the 22nd at 8 a.m. But we don't do an in-class. So I'm going to use the same date but make it a take-home exam, 24 hours long. Okay? So keep that date in mind. If there is a conflict with this date, you need to let me know sooner rather than later. Okay, that's the reason I'm letting you know what... Yes, you have a question. Electronic. Yeah. So you can send back a PDF or a text. So it's all, I'm going to put up the exam on the web page on the day of the exam. You just download it. You don't have to come in. You download it. You work on it. You email back a solution. Okay. All right. So what I'm going to do today is just wrap up the discussion on file systems and start a new topic, which is World Wide Web. This is going to be chapter 12. From the book, and then we are going to go back, finish distributed object system that we skipped. Okay, so that's what the plan is. So we were talking about, if you remember, about XFS last time, and I introduced one of the 2 main concepts that XFS uses, namely striping. Okay, just to recap, striping is a way by which you take a file, you chop it up into smaller pieces. Disk blocks, and then you store these blocks onto multiple disks. Okay, so in other words, the file system itself spans multiple disks, and not all files are stored on a single disk. So we said that this improves performance, gives you load balancing, and so on. But at the same time, you have to worry about disk failures and reliability, because the failure of any disk will make all files unavailable, or pieces of all files. So whenever you have striping, you keep redundant information called parity. So this is referred to as the parity disk in this case, which allows you to reconstruct disk blocks even if there are single disk failures or single server failures. Okay, that is striping. The other technique that is used by XFS is what is called a log structured organization of data. Okay. To understand this, let me give you a little bit of background. So this is based on this idea comes from a file system that was designed that's called a log structured file system, or LFS. Okay. And there was a key design insight behind the design of LFS. And let me try to explain what that is. Okay. So let's assume you have a normal file system that is stored on a single disk. Okay. And then there is a server that is serving these files to clients. Okay, this is a network file system or a distributed file system, and here is a cache. The cache is in memory. So whenever a request comes in, the file system has to first see if the requested data blocks are already in the cache, Okay, if so, you just retrieve them from the cache and respond. Otherwise, you go to the disk, retrieve that block, and you respond to the request. Okay, this is how any file system works. Now, if you look at technology trends, what has been happening is the sizes of disks have increased, okay, and so have sizes of memory. Okay, so now you can buy servers with several gigabytes of main memory. Okay, and if this is a file server, then a large fraction of that may be used to store your memory cache blocks. Okay, so what does that mean? So there are these read and write requests that are coming in. Okay, if you have large caches on the servers, what does this mean for the requests? Okay, what behavior do you expect from the file system whenever you have large caches that sit in front of the disk? Yes, you expect if the cache sizes are large, you expect that large number of requests are going to see cache hits. Okay? If you have a cache hit, then the response, the time that the request sees, goes down because you don't have to go to a slow disk. You're just serving the request directly from data that's already available in memory. Okay? So if memory sizes increase, okay, cache hits also go up. Okay, this is the first thing that you observe. So now cache hits are only relevant for read requests. Okay, because when you do writes, you have to eventually write it out to disk, so you can't prevent that. Okay, now if there are large caches and the large number of reads are being serviced from the memory cache, what do you expect to see at the disk level? What kind of traffic would you expect to see at the disk level?
Less traffic.
There's less traffic, but what type of traffic? Surely there's going to be less traffic, because if n requests come in, significantly smaller than n requests will actually hit the disk, because many of them are going to be absorbed by the cache. So, since reads are getting absorbed by the memory cache, it's mostly the writes that are trickling down. Okay, so whenever you put large caches, what happens is, even if there were equal number of reads and equal number of writes, or even majority of the traffic was read and only a small fraction of the traffic was writes, at the file server level, what you see at the disk level is predominantly write traffic, because all the reads are getting absorbed by the cache. Okay, yes, question. It doesn't matter whether it's a write back cache or a write through cache. Eventually, dirty blocks are going to have to be flushed out. Okay, even if it's write through or write back.
But if the memory size is increasing, then the write traffic also should go down.
Right? It will, no question, it will go down. If it's a write back cache, you will do some write coalescing here, meaning multiple writes to the same block will be observed by the cache before it's flushed out. But you will never see reads if most of the reads are going to be absorbed here. Yes, then no question there will be some misses. All I'm saying is, what do you expect to see here? And you will see that the traffic mix will change. This mix that you see here and this, the mix that you see here, will be very different. This will be write dominated, even if this is read dominated. Yeah, that's basically a simple observation to make. It doesn't matter whether the cache is write through or write back. It's still going to be there. And it's not that there are no reads. It's just that the fraction of reads that get absorbed has gone up. Okay. So the fundamental observation that the log structured file system people did was that if the disk sees predominantly write traffic because caches are absorbing reads, then your file system should be optimized for writes and not reads. Okay, because that is what the disk is seeing. Why, if there are not very many reads, then why not optimize for the common case, which is writes? So suppose now you want to design a file system that you want to optimize for writes. What does that mean? Okay, what can you do to optimize writes? Okay, that's a question to think about. So for that, you need to understand how disks behave. Okay, so I presume most of you know what a disk does. So let's just take, so any disk actually has a number of platters. Each platter is like a CD or a DVD, right? So, but there are many of them. Let's just take one. Okay, that is in a disk. So this thing is spinning. Okay. And then there's a disk head. Okay, so data is actually stored in concentric tracks. Okay, the disk head positions itself. It can move back and forth, and it can position itself on any track and read data from that track. Okay, that's how a disk behaves. So whenever you need to either read or write, you need to first move the disk head to the right track. Okay, that's called a seek. Okay, this is called a disk seek. So the first thing that you do whenever you have to read or write is you say which track is that data on, and you will move the disk head back or forth. Okay, and then once it's on the right track, you have to wait for the right sector to actually spin and appear under the disk head. At that point, you can actually read or write to it. Okay, is that clear? So suppose that this is the track, but this is spinning, so the data that you want to write, read or write is this sector. So you have to actually wait for it to spin and appear under the read-write head. At that point, you can actually read or write to it. Okay, this is called a rotational latency. So at that point, you can actually do something useful. So any disk read or disk write involves a disk seek and disk rotational latency, which is waiting time, because the disk is not doing anything useful at that point. It's just trying to position the disk head to the right location so it can do something useful. Okay. Now, if you want to optimize for writes, what would you do with this background information? That's how a disk behaves, and now you want to design an organization that's going to be write optimized. So you want to ensure that seek distance is as little as possible. In other words, what you want to do is you want to ensure high write throughput. That's what you mean by optimizing for write. How would you optimize for write throughput? You would want to minimize any wasted time, right? That is, you want to minimize the disk seek and rotational latency as much as possible, so that most of the time the disk is doing useful work, which is actually writing data, not moving the head around in order to write data. Okay? So how would you do this? If you want to minimize disk seek and rotational latency, what simple observations can you make about the file system? What should it do? You can what?
You can cache the write data and reorganize the data.
How? What do you mean reorganize to do what?
For example, if you get two requests and you can adjust the write sequence according to the sequence in the disk.
Right. So what you are suggesting is whenever write requests come in, you try to service them in an order that minimizes seek. So disks will already do that. That's called disk scheduling. Whenever multiple requests come in, they look at the current position of the head and they always try to service these requests so that the disk head movement is minimized. Okay, that is what is already being done. What else could you do in addition to this?
Are we assuming that there's a lot of new files being written or changing files?
Files are changing. New files could be written, and existing files can change. We cannot make any assumption on what the writes do. Okay, so you want to leave space so that you can write data without having to move. Okay? Right. Okay, so try not to fragment. Store data contiguously, yes.
Write subsequent blocks on consecutive
letters. Okay, write subsequent blocks on consecutive letters. So both of you are right in what the file system will do. You basically want to reduce disk head movement. Okay, so what that means is that what's the most trivial way by which you would not have any seek or rotational latency is to write sequentially or contiguously. Because you start from the innermost track. As data is arriving, you just keep writing sequentially and then you keep moving outwards. Okay, so you are doing sequential append. So you don't have to move the disk head because the disk head is already positioned on the right track. So you go wait for the next sector, you write empty sector, you write it there. And so you write sequentially. Okay? Now this is referred to as an append-only log because you are just writing in an append-only fashion. You are not moving the disk head around. Okay, so you are writing sequentially to disk. This is going to give you maximum disk throughput. Okay, just a sequential read through the disk also minimizes seeks and gives you maximum read throughput. Sequentially writing out data blocks gives you maximum write throughput. Okay, that's essentially what the log structured file system does. It takes all these observations and says, let's try to optimize the file system for writes. So the best way to write is to assume that the disk is one log and you just keep writing to the tail of the log downwards. So this minimizes your disk head movement as much as you can. Okay. Now, what does this mean? So whenever you want to write any data, you have to be able to write it to the next empty sector on your disk or the next block of your log. Is that clear? What we are saying? So if you are creating a new file, you are going to just allocate space in the next few blocks of the log. That's how you are going to keep writing data. Okay. Now you may have written some file here, and now you want to go and modify it. In a normal file system, what you would do is you would actually go back to that location and overwrite that block, because you already allocated space. You are updating the block, so you go and just overwrite it. If you do that here, then you have introduced a disk seek. Okay, so if your disk head is here, you're writing linearly into the log, and then a request comes in, says go and update that block I wrote some time back. So you would have to then go back there and actually write to it. Okay? So to avoid this, you would not do that. We would actually write the block out here. Okay, the new block is written out here, and this block is marked as dead. Okay, I'll come to that in just a moment. Okay, is that clear what we just said? So you are going to, even though you may have already allocated or written out the file, any updates to the file are always written to the tail of the log. Okay. Now the question was, how do you mark it as dead? So there are ways to do this. So you would have to keep a free block list. Okay, so you would have to then say that block is gone, and you would have to update the inode for this file, because the inode for that file, let's say block I was pointing there. You updated the block. In typical file system, you just overwrite it. There's nothing to be done at the inode level. Okay, you just overwrite that block. The block is still in the same position. Here, that block has been marked as dead, and you have moved it here. So you have to go and update the inode.
Is the inode memory?
Yeah, so I'll just come to that. You have a question?
Well, this is actually more efficient than having to go back and overwrite the block, since you have to update the inode anyway.
Yes. So good question. So now you are saying you have to update the inode. That's the same thing you asked. Is it in memory or is it on disk? Inodes have to be stored on disk, right? So it's not going to be, you can cache them in memory, but you have to store them on disk. So you are going to say, okay, the inode was stored here, right? So now we have to figure out where to put the inode. Or if you go and update the inode there, then you introduce the disk, right? So what the log structured file system does is it also writes the inode out to the tail of the log. It doesn't keep inodes in a fixed location on disk. Okay. Now this introduces one more level of indirection, which is where is the inode, because the inode itself is also moving. In the normal file system, inode is in a known location. Okay. So everything is written as a log. All the metadata is written out as a log. All the data is written out of the log. Updates, to make any updates, don't go and go back to the old block. You just write out a new version at the tail of the log, and just you will have to reclaim the old blocks. Okay? So this is what the log structured file system concept is. Also a very good idea, because it's trying to optimize for write throughput. Okay, but there are problems with this approach. Okay, so what do you see as some of the problems? So fragmentation is an issue, because there are all these dead blocks or holes that you've introduced. Okay? And so you are eventually going to reach the end of the disk. Right? So this looks nice so long as there is space, but now when you cycle back, then what do? Right? So you will basically have to look for these holes and write there. Okay? But eventually your disk is going to be fragmented. So the distance between holes is going to introduce additional seeks for you. Yeah, so you are going to eventually have these problems. So what you have to do here is garbage collection. The same thing you do in Java. And so you have all these holes. So you do compaction. So you say, so here is one hole and here is another. There's a little bit of data here. So you will take that and you will write it out to the tail of the disk. So now you have created a large empty space here. Yeah, this is called segment cleaning operation. So you do this. So then when you cycle back, you have a large segment here that you can write out as a log. Okay, so you are writing logs in granularity of segments. Okay, so you have this thing called a segment, which is a large amount of space. Let's say it's 1 megabyte. I'm just giving you a number. It has many disk blocks. So if you have an entire segment free, then you just use that segment. So then you move to the next free segment and you do this. But this requires you to do garbage collection, which means your files are constantly moving on disk, even if you don't write to your data. Okay, your data may still get moved around to reduce fragmentation. So this means there's some background work that the file system has to constantly do to free up segments where there's only a small amount of valid data and a lot of dead data. That's a good candidate to compact and move that data out. Okay? So you have to do all of these operations, which is expensive, because I mean it has been shown that segment cleaning overhead is non-trivial. That's 25% of the writes in your file system, because you're constantly moving data. So that's additional writes that you just introduce, even though the users may not be writing it. So up to a quarter of your write throughput will end up going, depends on the cleaning policy, of course, or the garbage collection policy, but up to a quarter of the writes are segment cleaner writes. They are, in effect, wasted writes. Right? So you effectively reduce the write throughput that it's available outside the file system by a quarter. So there are problems like this with the approach that you have to deal with, but other than that, it's a nice observation that this is the way to organize data on disks, append as an append-only log, and that gives you high write throughput. Okay? Now do remember that if there are read misses in the memory cache, you may still have to go back and read old data. It's not that all the seeks are gone. Whenever you have to service reads, you still have to go from the tail of the log to some other place, read it, and then you come back here. Yeah, so there is going to be some seeking regardless because of read misses. But otherwise, you get good performance, okay, barring the segment cleaning problem. Okay, is that clear what a log structured file system is? Okay. So with that background, this is the same thing that XFS uses. So it basically assumes that you will store data as a log. Okay. Now the interesting thing here is this log structured file system is combined with striping. Okay, so you're not storing the log in an append-only fashion on a single disk. Rather, you're chopping it up and you're storing them in round-robin order across disks. And when you cycle back and you come, let's say, to block 4, that is stored adjacent to block 1. So within a disk, you're still writing sequentially. But now blocks are also striped at the same time for higher performance. Okay, so you combine the log-structured idea with striping to get better performance while still using write optimizations. Okay, that is the basic idea in XFS. Okay, so it combines these two techniques into one. Any questions here?
Why does it do that? Even higher write throughput? Because files and...
Right. So this is only going to optimize on a single disk, right? So you're still bound by the throughput of a disk. So if your read volume or write volume is very high, you have to go beyond a single disk. So that means you have to use striping. Right? So striped file systems give you up to n times the disk throughput at the file system level. So you're combining these two ideas to get very good performance. Okay. Now the basic idea, so if you remember, the reason we said this is XFS is there is no file server in this case. Right? So that was the other idea that is a contribution of XFS. There's no notion of a file server. Any machine can act as a server. That was the whole idea behind XFS. So that's what has happened here. So all the disks of any machine that's part of the system can participate in the file system, and then you will be striping across these disks. Okay, so small pieces of data scattered all over, and then you can get this high amount of parallelism, and you use this log structured organization. But this also introduces complexity, okay, because inodes are no longer in a known location. They are scattered everywhere. Every time you update, the inode itself goes to a different location. So you have to have multiple levels of indirection in order to get to any data block. And that is what is shown in this picture. Okay. So in this case, it shows that there are seven levels of indirection in order to get to a data block the first time you access a file. Okay, so every time you access a file for the first time, you have to first get the inode, and then you get to the disk block. In a normal file system, the inode is on a known location, so you don't have to figure out where it is. You know where it is already. Okay, you just go there, read it, and then you can go and read the blocks of the file. Here, the inode could be anywhere, okay, because their philosophy is anything, anywhere, meaning that you will use all of the disks available, but all of the data can be scattered anywhere on disk, including the metadata. So here are all the levels of indirection you have to go through to even get to the inode. So there's something called a directory. It stores what are called manager maps. These are the machines that are participating. Okay? The manager maps themselves store an IMAP, which is an inode map. That's a table that tells you where is the current inode for file I stored. Okay? Because that information is now another table. You have to keep that information around. So you go get the IMAP. Okay, so IMAP will say it's in some stripe group. Okay, then you basically go to the stripe group map and say where is block I of that stripe group, and then that gives you a particular disk on one of the machines. That's where you go get the inode. Okay, once you get the inode, you have an index that points you to a disk block. So you then go back and look at the stripe group, and you get that disk. Okay. So the downside of doing all of this is there are multiple levels of indirection. But this doesn't happen on every write. All of these happen at file open time, because at open time you get hold of the inode. Once you have the inode, then the data block accesses are much more efficient. Okay, so file open has become complex because getting to the inode involves more levels of indirection. Any questions? Is this clear what I just said? Okay. So there is a table here which shows you what all the data structures are, but I've explained most of them, so I'm not going to go into any more details here. So the three things to keep in mind about XFS is there's no server. Okay, it's a serverless file system. Or think of it as a peer-to-peer file system, not as a file sharing system, but any machine can be is a peer, meaning it can act as a server or a client, okay, depending on what operations are being invoked on that machine. Second is that you use network striping to get high performance. And the third is it uses log-structured organization to optimize for write throughputs, because most of the disk traffic is predominantly writes when you're large cache. So these are the three key observations that we use in the context of XFS. Okay. Yes.
Like file serverless, how did it become, like, what design consideration made it serverless?
Okay, what design consideration made it serverless? So I talked about that briefly last time. So the basic observation was that machines are powerful.
I'm trying to understand, like, how come it achieves the serverless design?
How does it achieve the serverless design?
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's basically a philosophical thing as to what's a server and what is not, right? So in a normal client-server architecture, there's a machine that's basically a server. Okay, and there are many clients. Okay, and they send requests to the server and get data. Okay. In an XFS, you just make this a big pool. Right? So there are machines. Okay, there are users on some machines, and they all have disks. Right? So you take all the disks on all of the machines, and then you make it part of the file system. Okay, so this machine can act both as a client and a server. If there's an application wanting to read, then it becomes a client and it basically can go and get data from any of these disks depending on how it is striped and where is your inode and so on. Okay, at the same time, if some other application running on some other machine wants a data, this becomes a server. It is serving data blocks and metadata and so on. Okay, so in this sense, there is no distinguished machine that is called a server. Every machine acts as both a client and a server, which is what they mean by a serverless design.
So the network striping basically enables this.
The network striping enables this because you take a file and then you'll store a block here and a block here and a block here and so on. So you're basically storing
some top-level metadata like this directory and basically and all this. Where are these things stored?
Right. So these are also striped. Okay. So they can also be spread around. But at some level, you want some handle to get into this, right? So the directory itself, you store on some smaller number of machines at known locations. Because if everything is anywhere, then there is no way to get to the top level metadata. So this is also replicated and stored on multiple machines at known location. But once you get there, then these have pointers that allow all of these other data structures to be stored anywhere. Okay? So that's the basic. Yes, exactly. So they are super blockers, equivalent of those. Okay. So there is also a paper I have put up on the reading list that it's a very nicely written paper that explains this in an easy to understand way, and also there's some material on this in the textbook. So you should look at both to understand this a little better. Okay? Because it's a very different design philosophy from everything you have seen. So it's worth understanding as to what they do and why they do it. Okay. So that's all I'm going to say about file systems, and now we'll move on to the next chapter, which is web-based systems. So the reason I'm doing this a little out of order is some of these concepts are applicable to the third project as well. So I wanted to talk about them one more time, although we have spent a little bit of time on these ideas already in earlier classes. Okay. So you know what the web looks like, right? And we've talked about this many, many times. there are typically two entities. There's a browser that acts as a client, and there's a web server that is serving web pages. So typically you use the HTTP protocol to access web requests. This is done by sending an HTTP request to the server to access a file. Okay. The server can then get the data from a local file system and send back a response. Okay. That's basic idea of what a web's client server system looks like. Now we'll talk more about HTTP today, just to understand what this does and so on. But before we do that, it's important to realize that not all files that are stored by the web server are the same. Okay, there are different file types that it stores. And when it responds with to answer any request, it also embeds the file type or the in the response so that the browser can interpret it accordingly. So if you are requesting an HTML file, then you will get a file type that indicates that that's the type of the file. If you're requesting an image, you'll get back in the response, it'll tell you, is it a GIF image or a JPEG or a PNG or what's the form of the image? Or is it an audio file or a video file and so on. So this is done using what are called MIME types. Okay? So the same concept is also used in email. When you send an attachment, you also send with your email what is the type of the attachment so the client at the other end can understand the data. Here's the same thing is done here. So every file is tagged with its type. That's the basic thing to keep in mind. So you have different types, text, image, audio, video. You can send apps or you can just send multi-part MIME types. And then within each you can have different subtypes. Okay, so you can have a plain text file or an HTML file or an XML file. So you send this information back to the browser so the browser can interpret it accordingly. It doesn't have to actually look at the data to figure out what type it is. You are told what type it is and you just do the right thing, okay, to render that data at the browser end. Okay, so MIME types are used in HTTP. This is the first point to keep in mind. And this is done regardless of whether it's rich data. So you have to do the same thing for audio and video, okay, as you do for images and text. Okay, so you have seen this picture. This is what you are already using in your projects as well. So larger server, so in the previous case, the server was a single machine. Okay, but when you have large websites, the server comprises of multiple machines that use a multi-tier architecture. Okay, so there's a HTTP tier, there's an application tier. In this case, it's CGI. But you could use Java or J2E or servlets. There are a variety of mechanisms to implement the middle tier. And the back tier is always a database. Okay, so requests arrive here. You do HTTP processing. Okay? And then you send it on to the next tier to do the next level processing. This is where the application logic is written. Okay, and then that frequently requests data from the database in order to respond to the request. Okay. So keep this in mind. We are going to come back to that in just a moment. Okay. Now the other thing that other technique that is used in the context of the web is what is referred to as web services. Okay. The web services model, we assume that the client is not necessarily a user, okay, that is using a browser, but it could be another machine running another application. Okay, this is just a way for two applications in a distributed system to talk to one another over HTTP. So we know a variety of mechanisms for components in a distributed system to communicate. Okay, you could use RPCs, you could use RMIs, you could just set up a plain socket connection and write your own protocol. Okay. Now, since HTTP has become very popular, HTTP is also a protocol that you can use for two application components to talk to one another.
Why do we use over HTTP and why not directly?
Yes, that's a good question. Why do you? No, this is a good point as to why you would want to do this over HTTP. It is just that HTTP is popular, widely used, de facto, so you're layering stuff on top of HTTP. And it's platform independent. So if you use RPCs or RMIs, you have to choose a language, you have to choose a variety of things. Here you're using HTTP as your communication protocol, and you're layering things on top of HTTP. Okay? So, I mean, there's no fundamental reason you couldn't do it any other way. This is just the way it is done. Okay, so you just have to accept that. So if you use this, so here is one application, there's another application, they're talking over HTTP. Okay, now how do they communicate? So what you do is you actually send RPC commands that are encapsulated as HTTP protocol command. Okay, so a client can invoke a RPC at the server, but the way you send RPC request is you send it as an HTTP request. Okay, and the RPC request is encapsulated in it. Okay, and then the server is going to receive it, and then it will execute the RPC request and send back a response. Okay, so you'll see your familiar picture here. There's a stub, as in any RPC, client stub and server stub and so on. And this is HTTP. Okay? So it says SOAP, but this is basically a protocol that's layered on top of HTTP. Okay, I'll just show that in just one moment. Okay. And there's what is called a service description language. This is similar to your interface definition language. So when you create a SOAP application, you have to write, here is basically the set of RPC commands this application is going to support. Okay. So you write that as a WSDL or web services description language. And then you generate stubs which are then linked to the client and the server application. So it's a very similar idea, except that RPC is an RMI, is an over TCP, and this protocol runs over HTTP. Okay, in other words, the server basically listens on to port 80, which is HTTP, and it's just getting RPC requests encapsulated as HTTP commands. Okay, so here is a example of a SOAP request. Okay, so this is nothing but an RPC request. Okay, it's encapsulated as an XML file. And this XML file is itself encapsulated as an HTTP command and sent over. Okay, so this is basically, so here what you're doing is you're trying to raise an alert. Okay, so you can make a request or you can get back a response. So here you're basically getting an alert saying you need to pick someone up at 2 o'clock, and it's basically something around that time. So you send an XML request, or in this case it's an XML response saying this is what needs to be done, and the application is going to make take appropriate action. Okay? So we'll not go into details of SOAP and XML. I just wanted to show you an example command just to give you a flavor. Okay? So this is RPC looks in the form of a text message. Okay? So here is basically the function that you need to invoke that's encapsulated in there. Okay? There's a priority that's mentioned. There is a time value that's associated, saying the request needs to be processed by a certain time and so on. Yes?
Isn't XML too much overhead? I mean, instead of binary structure?
Yes, absolutely. So XML is, I mean, you could obviously have done this over TCP, you're doing it at HTTP. On top of this, you're sending everything as a XML file in text format. So all you have basically done is you have invoked in this whole thing, you invoked this function with this string. Okay, so that's an alert control that's probably going to pop up a message box on your machine. And the message is going to say this. Okay, it's this string. So rather than saying alert control and you just pass a string to a function, you have done all of this. Okay, but all that said, yes, high overhead, but this is now going over HTTP, it's easy. Anything can parse it, it's well defined, and it's a web standard, so it interoperates with all platforms and so on. So you pay the overhead of all of this, but you get, if you can talk HTTP and you can talk SOAP, then any other platform that does the same can talk to you. That's the basic idea.
But RPC already has an independent format.
No, there's no question that RPCs can do the same thing. This is RPCs in HTML and XML lingo. So SOAP is basically an RPC based system at the end of the day. It's just that you're using the XML to invoke an RPC request rather than a function name. Okay. Now don't ask me to justify why this is good. I'm just trying to say that this is widely used, but it has its own overhead. It's not going to be fast, okay, in terms of processing overheads and so on. But it is a standard, and if you use it, so this is now, this may be a simple example, but in what are called business to business application, this is widely used. So you may have a manufacturer, okay, that is trying to sell its products, and you have a customer that wants to buy. Okay, if you want to place an order rather than having a person make a request over a phone or just filling a web form, you can have programs talking to one another. Okay. So using XML as a way to do this across organizational boundaries is good, because you don't have to worry about platform compatibility, or this only works on Java 1.4, and if you have 1.5 it doesn't work. All that goes away. So you use this way to have applications talk to one another. That is what web services are used for. Okay, so each web service component exports some interface. That's some other application. Just as you build a distributed application using RPC, the same thing is true here. Okay, is this clear? So the main advantage is interoperability, not efficiency, not performance, but interoperability, because web applications are widely deployed. Okay, and this is why easy to understand. HTTP is a standard, so all this is laid on top. Okay. Any other questions or comments here? Okay. So here is, so we'll do a switch and come back to clients and servers now. So this is what a browser looks like. I think we did this in chapter 2 already. So your browser has many components. That is the user interface. That's what the user is seeing. So this is the window and so on. As a browser engine, okay, this is what is going to process the request and the responses. There's a rendering engine which takes the responses, maybe their images, and then it has to display the image or render it onto the screen and so on. And there are plugins into the browser. So this is an XML and an HTML parser. So if you want to send an HTML request, get an HTML file, you have to parse it to understand it. If you get an XML response, then you also you have to parse it. Okay. Many browsers now support XML, because HTML files embed XML data as well. Okay. If you have XHTML, there may be XML markups in HTML, so you have to have an XML parser in your built into your browser. Okay. There may be a script interpreter. Okay. So if you have JavaScript embedded into your HTML, okay, you need JavaScript support in the browser. So when you do form filling, this JavaScript may do checks saying, is the date in the right format, and is the zip code 5 digits, and that kind of stuff can be done, or checks can be done at the client end without having to send the form to the server and getting a response saying there's an error. So that's the reason you have a client-side interpreter. This is a network communication model. This is what is doing socket communication, TCP communication with the server. Okay. So your browser, today's browsers are complex applications which have lots of these components. And this is the reason you see the sizes keep going up all the time. Okay. So we have seen this picture already, and we are going to expand on that today. Okay. So this is where a proxy sits between a browser and a server. Okay. This shows an FTP server, but it doesn't matter. This could be an HTTP server. So when you have a client proxy server architecture as opposed to a client server architecture, clients typically send their request to the proxy rather than to the end server. Okay. The proxy may have a cache, in which case it will probably look at the cache to see if the request is already cached there. If so, you get back a response immediately. If not, it will go and get the data from somewhere. Okay. Typically the origin server, but need not be, as we'll see in a few slides. Yes. How is end-to-end reliability maintained? So both of these connections, so there are two connections here. There's a connection between the browser and the proxy, and there may be an optional connection between the browser, rather the proxy, and the server if this is a cache miss. Okay. So both of these are over TCP. Okay. To that extent, the requests are going over a reliable channel. Beyond that, there is no reliability guarantees. The server crashes and there's a cache miss, there's nothing you can do. Okay, if there's cache data, you may be able to serve it while the server has gone down. But if it's a miss, there's nothing else you can do there. Okay, so network level reliability is TCP. Server level reliability, you need replication, which is not shown here. Any questions there? Okay. So this is Apache. We had looked at this picture in a slightly different way sometime back. This is what the Apache architecture looks like. Okay, so there's a notion of a core. This is where requests come in. Okay, and then there's a notion of a hook. Okay, so basically it uses, the thing to keep in mind is there's this notion of a pipeline. Every request goes through this pipeline and undergoes processing at each step in the pipeline. Okay, and so the hook is basically a set of functions that are related to one another. So whenever a request comes in, the first thing that you have to do is parse the request. This may be an HTTP request. Okay, so you have to parse the request to understand what is it that is being requested. Okay. So there is an HTTP parser and HTTP processing. That could be a set of hooks. Okay. So once you have figured out what the HTTP request is, maybe it's what is called a GET request. That's the simplest request where you're requesting a file. Yes, if you just say get index.html, you're requesting index.html on the server. Okay. So once you parse it, then you may have to do some file IO in order to retrieve that from disk. Okay, that could be another hook. Okay. Or there may be an Apache cache. If you enable the caching functionality, then this could be a set of functions that actually do cache lookups. Okay. Now if you know anything about Apache, you know that it is modular. In what that means is there are modules that you can plug into the architecture that extend the functionality. That is also done using the notion of a hook. Okay, so if you want to implement a new module, okay, so the code is written as a module, but that you have to also add some hooks into the architecture, which says where is that module going to sit in the pipeline. Okay, so for example, Apache itself has a load balancer or a dispatcher. Yeah, so if you remember in the multi-tier architecture, or whenever your application I showed that there was a dispatcher that receives requests and it sends it to the next tier. Okay. So Apache itself implements such a module. Okay. That would sit somewhere in this pipeline. After the request has undergone processing, is handed to the dispatcher and say, okay, send it to the next tier. So it is going to do that for you. Okay. So there are a number of modules which I will not talk about here. So you could have a PHP module or a JavaScript module and so on. Okay. So the basic idea is the architecture assumes that requests undergo processing in the form of a pipeline. From the time they come in, so it goes through this pipeline, then a response is generated that goes out. Okay. And to implement this pipeline, it has the notion of a hook. And each hook is a collection of functions that implement certain functionality at that stage in the pipeline. Okay. This is all on a single machine, incidentally. Okay. So the hook implements these functions. The request basically undergoes processing and then it goes out. Okay. It depends on how you have configured Apache, what hooks are enabled and what modules are enabled. Okay. So this is one way to look at the architecture. The other way to look at it is how have you implemented it? Is it a multi-threaded architecture or a multi-process architecture or an event-based architecture? That's another way to look at server architecture. Okay. So as you may know, Apache uses a combination of threads and processes. That is not shown in this picture. Okay, that's a different way to look at how do you implement this. So you have multiple Apache processes. Whenever a request comes in, you send it to one of the processes in the pool and say service this request. And that's Apache process is going to probably have multiple threads which it will use to implement these hooks. Okay, so you may have multiple threads, each of which does a certain job in the pipeline. Okay, so then you may have to send a request through multiple threads and then it comes out. Is this clear? What Apache? Why would you not have? So if you could do a thread per request as well.
I'm not saying one thread, one request, but you kind of mentioned that Python still is a map to threads.
Yes. So there is a variant of Apache that also uses a pure multi-threaded architecture, in which case you would have a pool and whenever a request comes in, you give it to a thread. That thread would then execute all of the hooks in the pipeline. There's another way to implement it is that you have a pool of processes. First hand it to a process. Within each process, you have multiple threads, each of which may implement different parts of them. So it's just different way of implementing the same thing. The advantage of having multiple threads is if you have multi-core or multi-processor, then you can have parallelism there. So that's an advantage. Right? We have already seen the advantage, disadvantage, multi-server, multi-process, multiple threads, event-based. Event-based is only one thread. Right? So that does all of this using asynchronous I/O. Okay, so all of that is still true here. Okay, so only thing I wanted to point out was Apache has this hybrid architecture. It still uses multi-process, but there is multi-threading also. Suppose multi-threading support as well in the architecture. Okay. So this is clustered servers. So here is where you start implementing scalability. This is something like what we asked you to do in the project. Right? So you have request comes in, it comes in to what is called a front-end server. This is also referred to sometimes as a load balancing switch or a dispatcher. Okay. So these are the replicas of the server, that each of which can service any request. So the job of the front end is to decide which of these web servers should service a new request. Okay, so it may use a round robin policy where each new request is sent to the next server. Okay, it could use least loaded policy where you keep track of the load on each server. So every new request is sent to the least loaded server, or any other policy. Okay, so we'll talk about content aware policies in just a moment. So here is another architecture. Looks more complicated than it actually is. Okay, so here there's a switch. Okay, so all requests arrive at the switch, and then they are sent to one of the web servers. Okay, so in this case, the switch is dumb. Okay, it's not doing anything. It could probably implement a simple round robin policy. Okay, so each incoming request is sent to the next server. Okay, now so the servers themselves are more, let's say, are more intelligent. Okay, so they can keep track of their load, their own load as well as load of their peers. So if a new request comes in, the server can decide, do I want to service it or should I give it to some other replica? Okay, which is why you have a distributor component on the server as well. So the server says, okay, the load is low, I can service it. It is just going to go ahead and do that. Okay, if not, you will have to decide which other server to choose. Okay, for this, in this case, there is a separate process called a dispatcher that will tell you which server to pick. So you just go to the server dispatcher and say, I need to pick a different server. Can you tell me which one? Okay, maybe it says pick that one. Okay, so then the request is handed to the distributor, which is basically just forwarding it to the other replica. Okay, so then it goes to this replica, and that replica services. Now, traditionally, you could implement the same functionality, all of this in the switch itself. Okay, this is just showing you a logical distribution, but you could, rather than complicating it, the dispatcher, the distributor, all of that, and the load balancer can all reside in the switch, in which case the request comes here. Look at the load balancing policy, you do the dispatching, and you just send it to the server, and that server just handles it. You don't have to redirect it anymore. But you have these more complicated architectures as well, where the functionality is split. Okay, there's some simple forwarding done, and then there's more complicated processing that's done to decide who actually services the request.
What is the advantage of the
second approach? Okay. So what's the advantage of the second approach? Now, there are many scenarios where you may not want to do some simple round robin policy. So key scenarios where that is true is where you have a notion of sessions or state that is maintained by the server. Okay, so think of a shopping session. You go to a website, okay, you started shopping, and maybe you put some items in the shopping cart. That is state that the server has maintained. In particular, when your replicas, one of these servers has that state, but not the others. Okay. So now when you subsequently say, let's say, buy or something like that, that's a request that's arrived at the switch. The switch does blind round robin. It may actually send it to a server. Okay? And that server may be the wrong one. That may not be the one that has your shopping cart state. So it cannot do anything with that request. Okay? So if you do that, that server may have to figure out who actually has session state and redirect that request. Okay? Now, of course, you could put that functionality in the switch. So the switch actually keeps a mapping for every session, what is the server that is servicing that session. So when the request comes in, it does a lookup saying, which session does this request belong to? Okay? And which server is servicing that request? And it will forward it there. In this case, it's not doing load balancing, because in a session, all requests have to be serviced. Once you have picked the server, all subsequent requests have to be serviced by that server. You can't send it to any other server, because only that server has your state. Okay? So you may have to do things like that. If the switch is stateful, you can keep session state there. If the switch is stateless, it is just going to forward it somewhere. But these web servers themselves have to keep track of who has state for which sessions, and then may have to redirect this request. Okay? So there are all sorts of architectures that people have designed, and it all depends on where the state is and where the intelligence is. Any questions here? Is this clear? Okay, so in your project, you don't have to do anything this complicated. You just have a simple load balancer. Just implement some load balancing policy. But as I mentioned last time, caching is where you really have to pay some attention. Okay, how are you going to handle caching and cache consistency issues? Okay, so I'm going to talk about one more issue with regards to HTTP, and then we'll talk about web caching and so on for the rest of the class. Okay, so this is basically this picture shows you what the HTTP 1.0 protocol does. Okay, in HTTP 1.0, every time you want to, every time let's say the user clicks on some link, okay, you set up a new TCP connection with the server, and you send a HTTP request over the TCP connection. And when the request, when the response is received, that connection is closed. And then if you then click on another link, even if it goes to the same server, you'll set up a new connection. So here is a scenario where it shows that there are three connections here that have been established with the servers for three requests. Maybe you got an HTML page and you ask for an image in the page and so on. So you set up three connections. Okay? So what this means is every time you send a request to the server, you have to set up a TCP connection and there's a TCP handshake over it that you have to pay before any HTTP processing happens. Okay. Now, in the context of HTTP 1.1, you can piggyback all of this on the same connection, okay, which means the first time you set up a connection and you get a response, the connection is not torn down. It is kept alive, and it's assumed that maybe you will again send more requests to the same server. If so, then you just piggyback that request onto this same connection. You don't have to set up a new connection and waste more overhead at the two ends. Okay? So these are referred to as persistent connections, or connections that are going to persist across HTTP requests. Okay? So the TCP connection, so each connection services multiple requests. In 1.0, each connection services only one request. Okay? So this is what I'm going to talk about today, and then maybe we'll stop there. So HTTP methods that are basically used. So this is the most common HTTP request, which is a GET. Okay. This just requests a document. So you can say GET index.html. It'll return you that file. Okay. The other form, so this is retrieving data. Okay. The other variant of GET is what is called PUT, where you're sending data to the server. This is what happens when you typically say submit to a form. You're sending data. Okay. So GET is equivalent of reading from the server. PUT is equivalent of writing to the server. Okay, so you fill a form, you say submit, all that data is sent and the server records that and does some processing. Okay, so there's GET, PUT, and there's a POST which is equivalent, which is providing data. Okay, there's also a delete option which is rarely used, which will ask the server to delete an HTML file. Okay, so typically browsers don't just go to the server and ask the server to delete files, but it is there in the protocol. Yeah, you can actually do that. And there's a head which basically just asks you for the head of the document, which allows you to do cache consistency and so on. Okay? So these are the most common methods. There are many more, but these are the common methods. And GET, PUT, POST are the more commonly used of the various HTTP methods. Okay? So actually, just one second. Let me check. Excuse me. You're here for the survey, right? Okay. All right, so I'm going to actually stop here for today because there is a course survey that we are going to do. Okay, so they need 15 minutes of our time to do it, which I had actually forgotten about. So let's stop here, okay, and we'll continue next time. Don't leave because they're going to come and ask you to fill out a form, which you should do, and hopefully there'll be some good benefit that come out of it. Okay, this is not course evaluation, it's just a separate survey that they're doing of various graduate courses. Okay? So we'll stop here.